This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, he writes the political economics column. He's based in London. And his most recent column addresses something that has overwhelmed my ability to understand, even summarize, but I'll make a try at it. This is global taxes. And in recent conversations, the G7 financial ministers, Secretary of the Treasury, Chancellor of the Exchequer, they have many names, but they're in charge of the treasuries of their G7 countries, the group of seven, including the U.S., of course, and all the said to be very 20th century developed countries. It's larger, but it can be a G10, a G20. This is the G7. Have presented the possibility of global tax plan. As I understand it, it's in three parts, and Joe will help me on this. The first part is taxing multinationals for their profits in individual countries. The second part is a minimum corporate tax globally so that you do not seek the lowest tax rate in a country here or there. You pay 15%, I think, is the recommendation. The third part is the mind twister, which I fail, which is to tax digital companies that don't actually have presence in the country. But, for example, Apple iTunes or Amazon, but do business in that country and then extract profits. Joe, you've written about the global tax man, so I hope I've done a partial job of explaining this overwhelming matter. My first question to you on this large story is, this is the beginning of a conversation, and the OECD is involved in it. Is it something that's been building for years, or is this fresh upon us? Thank you, Joe.
So we're kind of in the middle of a conversation right now, because this has been these proposals have been under discussion in various forms and under the aegis of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development for a long time. And there are actually really only two big components here. The first element of this is the digital services tax, because what's happened is, I mean, traditionally you would tax a company in whatever country it has its headquarters in, and then you would tax it on its profits. So the company is based in Silicon Valley. The U.S. gets its, you know, first crack at taxing that company's profits, even if that company does a lot of business in France and Germany. With a lot of these big tech companies like Google or Amazon, European countries especially have said, well, hang on a sec. I mean, these guys are earning a lot of revenue within our borders. We want to be able to tax that. So part of what the G7 finance ministers were discussing, you know, this past weekend was that issue. And they seem to have come across a form of agreement that might start allowing them to shift to this kind of tax that would basically be targeted at these digital companies, even though the text of the G7 communique doesn't specifically say that. I think that the French and British finance ministers are pretty clear that what they mean, you know, what they mean is American tech companies. And then the second thing that we're talking about is this idea of a global minimum tax that should apply, they think, to every company. And the idea is that you set a minimum rate, and then each country writes this into their laws. And then for the companies headquartered in a country, that country's tax authority looks at their total global tax rate, how much tax have they paid in every country where they do business, and if that were less than 15% of the company's taxable profits, the host country gets to impose a form of top-up tax. And that's supposed to blunt the effect of tax competition from low-tax, you know, places like Ireland or Hong Kong or Singapore, because companies would then face the same effective tax rate no matter where in the world they were headquartered. And the G7 also seems to be prepared to move forward with that. So it's like these two things that would, you know, represent a pretty big overhaul for the way the world's governments tax international corporations. And the whole point of it would be to try to make it harder for governments to compete with each other to attract business by reforming their tax codes, while also trying to generate more revenue for the governments.
Focusing on the digital tax, Joe, as I understand it, there have been routine, harsh conversations by European Union members, by OECD members, that this will not stand, that Apple and Amazon and Facebook and Microsoft, we could go on, are not going to be permitted to continue to do business because our revenues are falling, and we think it's because you're extracting business from us and not paying tax for it. First of all, is that accurate? And second, is that the start of a trade war talk, and will that be stemmed by these conversations?
The trade war, in a sense, is already here, because remember that several European countries, including the UK and France and Spain and Italy, have pushed ahead with their own versions already of a digital services tax. And I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions you can ask about how legal all of that is, because they're trying to upend arrangements that are set out in various tax treaties that they've signed, including with the U.S., but they're doing it anyway. And the Biden administration had threatened to impose tariffs on some of these countries' exports to America if they persisted with that. So in a way, what the G7 was doing is trying to avert that kind of trade war. But I think that the problem is that the target of this pretty overtly is the American tech companies. And in fact, Washington had previously, under previous administrations, had sometimes suggested, well, okay, we'll let you revamp the way you do the taxation so that you can do it in the market where the revenue is earned. But we want to apply that to all companies, and that would include French luxury manufacturers and German car makers. And wouldn't you know that when you do that, the Europeans become a lot less enthusiastic about this. So I think that really the story here is that these taxes are intended to be targeted at American tech companies. The surprise is that Janet Yellen and Joe Biden now seem to be prepared to go along with that. And that's because they want the minimum tax half of this. And so they think that if some ground on the digital tax, they can get that 15% global minimum tax, which is the thing that they're really eager for.
I read from your column, Joe, because I do not understand this entirely. The OECD estimates that the world's government collectively lose $240 billion in annual revenue under existing laws. That figure rises as high as $643 billion annually under the most inflated estimates propagated by proponents of a global minimum tax. Is the assumption that they will regain that money? And if they go forward with these negotiations, and is that money being regained, is that to be divided by OECD members? Is it to be administered by a super tax organization, a super IRS? How is that? If they get that money back, how do they allocate it? Do we know?
This is kind of one of the sillier elements of this discussion, frankly, because no one can say for sure exactly how much revenue is out there. So, I mean, these estimates are all based on the notion that, first off, somehow the tech companies are paying too little tax. So they would be paying more tax in a lot of these markets where they operate under the digital half of that. And then it's also based on this argument that you have all of this awful tax competition, and companies save all of this money, and other governments lose out on all of this tax revenue, because right now you can plop your corporate headquarters down in Dublin and pay a 12.5% tax rate there instead of paying the 19% rate in the UK or the 21% rate in the U.S. And so somehow, if we could eliminate that incentive and the companies relocate to the countries where they're from, or something like that, they would be paying more tax. And so you get these estimates like that $240 billion number from the OECD. That is saying that the world's governments individually would end up collecting a total of $240 billion more. And it's not a matter that there would be a global IRS that would be collecting this. It's just that every country would be changing its individual tax laws in a way that would generate all of this revenue. Now, I mean, no one ever says exactly how they arrive at these numbers. You have to assume that you could increase all of these taxes without denting corporate profits in any way, or denting the incentive for companies to invest, which is where the future revenue comes from. And it also assumes that these economists have correctly estimated how much revenue is actually left uncollected out there. There might be a lot less, and historically tax increases generate less revenue than the proponents claim. But it's also important to remember that $240 billion is not a big number compared to what all of the world's governments have been spending in recent years. So we're talking about these big big changes to tax laws and economic incentives and potentially economic growth and job creation without really having a huge amount of revenue on the line.
Inflation, a story we've watched for months and months and months. I read in the headlines in the United States, in Washington, in New York, this is the Wall Street Journal, a commodities crunch caused by stingy capital spending has no quick fix. This is reported from Asia. Producers have slashed capital spending on major resources by nearly half over the last decade, shrinking stocks of industrial metals to two-decade lows. The crunch is now converging with a buying spree in key markets to supercharge prices. Is this inflation, Joe? Is this temporary inflation? Is this something that was predicted?
Well, it's, I mean, in theory, I guess you can argue that it's temporary because eventually the, you know, investment should pick up again responding to price signals in the market. Except, I mean, first off, it's not always clear exactly how well investment can respond to these incentives. Because remember, when you're talking especially about extractive industries like mining or drilling, the amount of regulation involved there now is really very hostile, and the Biden administration is going to be keeping a lot of new supply of, fuel in particular off the market with a lot of the restrictions they're talking about on things like fracking or pipelines or the like. So that is going to be one deciding factor in how long term this is. But I mean, remember also with a lot of these investment projects, it's not like you flip a switch and that new supply is going to be there tomorrow or next week or next month. I mean, you're talking years to get a new well or a new mine online in any sort of meaningful way where it could start affecting global prices for some of these commodities. And you can have a lot of dislocation and a lot of bad price signals between now and then. And at that point, it kind of, I mean, even if the specific bit of price movement that you're talking about does turn out to be temporary, a lot of the damage already is going to be done.
One more detail about inflation. China's producer price index, a gauge of factory gate prices, could climb to its highest level since August of 2008. Lumber, iron ore, and copper prices have hit records. Corn, soybeans, and wheat have jumped to their highest levels in 8 years. Oil reached a two-year high. Central bankers must decide whether to keep looking past the increases. Here's the puzzle. These prices, China fears inflation. Historically, Tiananmen was during a period of 20% inflation. The leadership fears inflation. They all grew up under inflation. They know it is a nightmare. So they have two choices. They can cut their profit margins or export inflation. Is that a problem for the U.S. if China exports inflation?
Well, yes. And I mean, it's sort of this difficult thing to talk about exporting inflation because, I mean, with a lot of these things, we are all in a global economy. So, I mean, if China is experiencing this kind of inflation for some of those inputs, it is because Chinese manufacturers are scrambling to buy all of these commodities so that they can manufacture exports that American consumers want to buy. So, I mean, what I find interesting right now is that it's becoming harder and harder to talk about inflation as a phenomenon that is confined to one economy's borders, precisely because you do have all of these really complicated supply chain linkages out there, and also all of these complicated financial linkages going on. So I think increasingly it's going to be the case that everyone's inflation is everyone's problem.
Joseph Sternberg, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, he's based in London. We're observing the globe from the London point of view, the city, Thames, the reopening London, but suddenly maybe not. So we're not sure, but certainly everybody still working remotely is watching these price changes. However, they also have a life. And if they're to be locked up again or locked down or restricted or prohibited in some fashion, if they're going to celebrate a staycation, as one minister recommends, a staycation, not to go abroad, what is to be done? When we come back, I've talked to Joe for more than a year about London parks in the pandemic. Well, I've learned that London is a city of parks, but they're pocket parks. They're micro parks. They're your backyard. Londoners and Britons and people who live in the United Kingdom make treasures out of their backyards. However, I learned that there are many regulations, many restrictions in these backyards, these micro parks. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.